The UN General Assembly gets underway in New York.
I called for this summit because our world is heading off the rails and we need tough decisions to get back on track.
Plus, Israel and Hezbollah trade cross-border artillery fire as tensions escalate.
I think what's happening in the south today is an effort by the Israeli Air Force and the Israeli military to make life for civilians in the south of the country untenable.
And later, Volodymyr Zelensky visits Scranton, Pennsylvania. A Middle Eastern broadcaster's Israeli bureau is raided, and Sri Lanka has a new president. Today is Monday, September 23rd, and this is VOA's Flashpoint. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. With the UN General Assembly underway in New York, leaders and diplomats are set to address a meeting to strengthen the United Nations. This a day after agreeing to work together to address a range of global challenges, including climate change, conflicts, and poverty. On Sunday, delegates gave their final approval to what's being called a Pact for the Future, which covers themes such as peace and security, sustainable development, digital cooperation, human rights, and gender. The pact was adopted at the opening of the two-day Summit of the Future called by UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
I called for this summit because our world is heading off the rails and we need tough decisions to get back on track. Conflicts are raging and multiplying, from the Middle East to Ukraine and Sudan, with no end in sight. Our collective security system is threatened by geopolitical divides, nuclear posturing, and the development of new weapons and theaters of war.
The 42-page Pact for the Future includes reforming the UN Security Council, moving away from using fossil fuels, listening to young people, and reforming the international financial system. Monday's Summit of the Future meeting is scheduled to include speeches from Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, Iran's new president Masoud Pezeshkian, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi, and Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Vershinin. Also in New York, Joe Biden makes his final presidential address before the UN General Assembly this week. VOA's White House correspondent Anita Powell takes a look ahead.
This is the last time President Joe Biden will address a major international forum, the hundreds of leaders who gather each year for the United Nations General Assembly. It comes at a clutch moment, says the U.S. ambassador to the global body. Linda Thomas-Greenfield is U.S. ambassador to the United Nations.
We say this every year, but this UNGA could not come at a more critical and more challenging moment. The list of crises and conflicts that demand attention and action only seem to grow and grow.
Atop that list, Gaza. Here, the U.S. position is not in line with the rest of the assembly, which last week overwhelmingly passed a resolution demanding that Israel end its occupation of Palestinian territory within the next 12 months. The United States was among the 14 no votes, which Thomas Greenfield said was in line with Washington's opposition to unilateral measures that undermine the prospect of a two-state solution. Analysts expect Biden to discuss his support of Israel and his support of Ukraine in this year's address. They spotlight those two conflicts as major challenges as he ends his presidency. Jim Kessler is Executive Vice President for Policy at Third Way.
With the Middle East, this looks like, you know, how do you keep the lid on this and see, hope the conflict doesn't spiral out of control into a regional war? And, you know, I think there's anybody's best guess about what's going to happen there.
One thing is painfully clear. As the conflict nears the one-year mark, nearly 100 hostages are thought to remain in Hamas custody. The White House says bringing them home is their top priority and the key pillar of a deal to halt the fighting between Israel and the militant group. Kessler said many leaders will give Biden a warm welcome during his valedictory speech, as he has used his term to rebuild alliances and reestablish global norms. Kessler again.
There is a lot of affection for him out there in most nations. Of course, there's a few where there is not.
Biden speaks in New York Tuesday. Anita Powell, VOA News, New York.
And on now to the Middle East, where tensions between Israel and Hezbollah have increased sharply in recent days after an Israeli strike on Beirut killed a senior Hezbollah official, Ibrahim Akil, as well as dozens of others. On Sunday, Hezbollah fired more than 150 rockets at Israel, damaging homes in the north of the country and sparking many fires. Israel continued to fire barrages of rockets at Lebanon. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
The Hezbollah rockets on Sunday reached deeper into Israel than at any time since the war between Israel and Hamas began almost a year ago. Although most were shot down, schools all over northern Israel closed and hospitals in northern Israel moved underground. One 17-year-old was killed when he lost control of the car he was driving during a rocket siren. Hezbollah said the rocket fire was aimed at the Ramat David Air Base near the northern city of Haifa. Several homes were damaged as residents hid in shelters.
We didn't think it would reach us here. Who is waiting for it? Who wants it? No one, certainly not us. It's hard, really hard. It's not easy. We have the holidays ahead of us. Who knows what will happen? With God's help, maybe it will get better.
In Lebanon, thousands attended the funeral of Ibrahim Akil, killed by Israel in a targeted airstrike Friday in Beirut. Hezbollah Deputy Chief Naim Qassem said attacks on Israel will continue.
Threats will not stop us, and we are not afraid of the worst-case scenario. We are ready to face all military possibilities.
Israeli analysts say that Hezbollah has suffered a severe blow in the past week, starting when thousands of pagers exploded in a complex operation attributed to Israel. Sarit Zahavi is an expert on Lebanon from the Alma Center.
It was a damage that made a lot of confusion and damaged the command and control of Hezbollah as an organization, which is, it's really difficult to have an organizational conduct of an army, and this is what is Hezbollah, when you don't have how to communicate, and 3,000 of your commanders or military operatives basically cannot function.
At the same time, she said that Hezbollah still has significant capabilities and tens of thousands of rockets. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the Hamas attack on Israel on October 7th was unprovoked, and Hezbollah joined the attacks on Israel the next day.
No country can accept the wanton rocketing of its cities. We can't accept it either. We will take whatever action is necessary to restore security and to bring our people safe back to their homes.
Israeli analysts say that so far, both Israel and Hezbollah have held back from a total war. Israel has not hit Lebanese infrastructure, such as power plants, and Hezbollah has not fired on central Israel. Giora Island, a former national security advisor, says that what happens next is up to Iran, which controls Hezbollah.
And the Iranian will tell them stop the war only if there is some kind of international pressure, American, French, and others, for the benefits of all of us. The Americans, the Iranians, and others, it is better to stop this escalation, because if we do not stop it, it will probably bring not only to total war between Israel and Hezbollah, but as many people estimate, it might create actually a regional war.
Israel remains on high alert for further Hezbollah attacks. Schools in northern Israel will remain closed and hospitals continue to operate underground. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
Israel is deepening its attacks against Hezbollah in Lebanon, and the public will have to remain calm over the next few days, Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said on Monday. It's a signal that he expects intensified fire from across the border. Tens of thousands of people have been evacuated from homes on both sides of the Israel-Lebanon border since Hezbollah began firing rockets at Israel in October in sympathy with Palestinians in Gaza. Meanwhile, in Lebanon, authorities say that 100 people were killed and at least 400 injured in Israeli strikes on Monday, mostly in Lebanon's south. For more, I'm joined by Jacob Russell in Beirut. Now, you've told us that most of the strikes were in the south of Lebanon. You're in Beirut. What's it like where you are? What are you seeing?
Well, Beirut today is essentially peaceful. There's not been any strikes inside the city today. There is a definite tension There's less traffic on the streets than normal. There's less activity in the city than normal. And there is in Beirut a sense that the situation, as has been going on since October the 7th, has now tipped for them, for Beirut residents, into a war. And they are starting to acknowledge it as a war, where for previous months it had been something that was happening in the south of the country and felt rather far away from the capital.
Well, and that's something I want to ask you about. It started after October 7th. Hezbollah was targeting northern Israel as a show of support with Hamas down in Gaza. Now that those strikes are getting larger and more into Israel's interior, Israeli retaliation is getting stronger. Is there a sense among Lebanese people who are not part of Hezbollah that Hezbollah has pushed it too far?
That's a very interesting question, and it's a hard question to get an answer from, because the popular Lebanese opinion is very much tied up with Lebanese politics, and with many people having quite a high level of loyalty to a particular political party, their opinions will go often with the guidance of that party. So there's a divide at the moment between people who, yes, they think that Lebanon is being dragged into a war that it or they don't deserve, or that they don't feel particularly implicated in, and people who feel that Lebanon is being attacked and that Hezbollah is the only force capable of putting up a defense at the moment. And also there is a section of people, although it's they're not necessarily a constituency that has much political weight, that think that what's happening in Gaza is so morally repugnant that they sort of implicitly support Hezbollah from a moral perspective. I think what's happening in the south today is an effort by the Israeli Air Force and the Israeli military to make life for civilians in the south of the country untenable. And most of the or many of the civilians in the south of the country do constitute Hezbollah's support base. So much as residents of northern Israel have evacuated for quite a long time, they're trying to force the issue with Hezbollah's support base, which until now has been standing by them. But they're trying to say, you know, if you continue to support them, this is what life will be like.
And how do you think that's going to work?
Well, that's the million-dollar question in a way, because it's a question of time, really, because there is an element of the more that Lebanon is attacked, the more that people respond to it by feeling a sense of loyalty to Hezbollah as defenders of Lebanon. But there is a point at which that will tip, because Lebanon is already a country in crisis, and the dispersion of, you know, hundreds of thousands of displaced people throughout the country is not easily done and will not be easily be sustained, either for those individuals in whatever living conditions they can find, or for the nation, for its economy, for its politics. So really, it's a question of time, and both sides are playing that game.
We've been hearing for a long time now that the attacks coming from Lebanon into Israel as a show of support for Hamas in Gaza would stop once there is a ceasefire in that war in Gaza. As things escalate, as they have been over the past few days, is there a sense that this war between Hezbollah and Israel will take on a life of its own and could even outlast the situation in Gaza?
I think currently Hezbollah's statement that if there were to be a ceasefire in Gaza, they would stop the aggression and the firing into Israel can be taken at face value. However, yes, there is a chance that the longer that this conflict goes on, the more it will develop its own internal momentum and the more independent of the situation in Gaza it will become. And there is, of course, a danger that Iran will be pulled into it militarily, because, of course, it's a staunch ally of Hezbollah and vice versa.
Regarding the situation in Gaza, there are talks in Qatar, there are talks in Cairo. The U.S. is involved diplomatically, as are other Western countries. Is there a similar ongoing negotiation process to end the hostilities between Israel and Hezbollah?
Yes, there certainly is a great deal of diplomacy going on to try and contain and eventually to end hostilities between Hezbollah and Israel. I think that they can't be, that diplomacy can't be separated conceptually into an effort that concerns Gaza and an effort that concerns Hezbollah, because they are, especially at the moment, completely tied to each other. So I think makes more sense to see that as one kind of unified diplomatic effort.
Very good. We're going to leave it there for today. Jacob Russell reports for VOA from Beirut. Mr. Russell, thanks for your reporting on this.
Thank you.
You're listening to Flashpoint from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is in the U.S. We'll learn more about what he's up to in a moment. First, though, more from the Middle East. Chris Dingman of Reuters reports on a recent Israeli move that has press freedom advocates worried.
Israeli forces raided the offices of Al Jazeera in the West Bank city of Ramallah on Sunday. The news network aired live footage of Israeli troops entering with weapons drawn and handing Bureau Chief Waleed Al-Amari a military order to shut down operations for 45 days. Al-Amari later spoke to Reuters, calling the raid a, quote, blatant attack on the network. He says it's an attack on the freedom of speech and the task of delivering the truth as well, and that the raid, quote, aims to obscure the truth. Al-Amari told Reuters the troops confiscated the Bureau's cameras before leaving. Later, Israeli armored vehicles were seen patrolling the area outside the Bureau. The Israeli military confirmed that equipment was confiscated and that the building was sealed, and told Reuters the order to close the Bureau was signed after an intelligence assessment determined that the offices were being used to, quote, incite terror and support terrorist activities. Al Jazeera, which says it has no affiliation with militant groups, has provided on-the-ground coverage of Israel's almost year-long military offensive in Gaza and of a parallel surge in violence in the West Bank. In a statement, the network called the raid, quote, a criminal act, and said it would take legal action to protect its rights and promised to continue its coverage.
That's Chris Dignam of Reuters reporting for us today. Turning our attention now to Ukraine and the latest from there, VOA's Anna Chernikova has the latest on Volodymyr Zelensky's travels and the most recent attacks.
All eyes in Ukraine are on President Zelensky's visit to the U.S., which began on Sunday at an ammunition factory in Joe Biden's birthplace of Scranton, Pennsylvania. Zelensky is expected to address the UN General Assembly and to present the Ukrainian so-called victory plan in its full-scale war with Russia when he meets with American officials. Reportedly, the plan includes the points of Ukraine receiving security guarantees from Western countries, the continuation of Ukraine's offensive in Russia's Kursk region to secure a territorial trump card in negotiations, requests for specific modern weapons, and international financial aid for the war-ravaged economy of Ukraine. Last week, Zelensky announced that the plan is 100% complete and will be presented to President Biden and both presidential candidates Harris and Trump. The meetings with President Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris are expected on Thursday. Meanwhile, President Zelensky met with Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro this past Sunday. During the Scranton ammunition plant visit, they signed a sister state agreement between Pennsylvania and Ukraine's Zaporizhia region. The plant produces components of artillery and mortar shells. It's operating at full capacity to meet Ukraine's needs, particularly for the production of 155mm projectiles.
I want you to know that in everything we have achieved so far, and most importantly, everything we can still achieve, our people and our Ukrainian bravery, you have become a part of it. Your help, your choices, your determination will not let freedom be lost.
Meanwhile, over the past week, the Ukrainian forces have carried out two strikes on a munition depot inside Russian territory. On September 18th, a fire and detonation were reported at a munition storage facility in the city of Toropetsk caused by a drone attack. On September 21st, drones attacked an ammunition warehouse in Oktyabrsky, Satellite images show that more than 58 warehouse buildings and several open areas with ammunition were destroyed, the railway damaged, and trains with ammunition destroyed. VOA cannot verify this information independently. In turn, Russia continues to attack Ukrainian cities and launch missile and drone attacks across the country. The latest attacks hit the cities of Kharkiv, Zaporizhia, and Kryvyi Rih, as well as a number of cities and villages in the Donetsk region. Casualties and injured civilians, including children, have been reported. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
Sri Lanka, which is emerging from its worst economic crisis in decades, has elected a new leader, but will he be able to continue the politically unpopular austerity measures that have helped the country's coffers? Sean Hogan of Reuters has more.
Sri Lanka's new leftist leader, Anuradha Kumara Dissanayake, was sworn in as president on Monday, promising change as the island nation emerges from its worst economic crisis in more than seven decades.
We have a deep understanding that we have got a challenging country. Our politics must be cleaner than this. There is a need for a political culture that people expect. We will commit ourselves to that. The public have a very negative view of politicians and politics.
Long led by powerful political families, millions of Sri Lankans voted for the Marxist-leaning parliamentarian.
Our main expectation is for the cost of living to reduce and the economic situation of the poor people to improve.
Dissanayake's first task will be setting up a new cabinet and wooing parliament, where his party has just three of 225 seats, and hoping to pass a budget under the terms of a $2.9 billion bailout from the International Monetary Fund. The country's economy buckled in 2022 under a severe foreign exchange shortage that left it unable to pay for imports of essentials, including fuel, medicine, and cooking gas. Before Monday swearing in, Prime Minister Dinesh Gunawardena resigned to make way for the Prime Minister and his new cabinet. Gunawardena took over as Prime Minister in July 2022 after former President Gotabaya Rajapaksa fled and resigned amid protests unleashed by the crisis. Sri Lanka's sovereign dollar bonds shed 2.88 to 3.28 cents on the dollar in early trade on Monday to bid between 49.14 and 49.77 cents. Investors worry Dissanayake's desire to revisit the terms of the country's IMF bailout could delay future disbursements, and that could seek to renegotiate a debt deal with bondholders finalised last week. However, constitutional lawyer Bhavani Fonseca told Reuters with Sri Lanka's economic reliance on international assistance, she doesn't expect the new president to act rashly.
So he'll be taking a very pragmatic approach, at least for the next couple of months. How things play out in 2025 and beyond is to be seen, but I think at the most immediate, he's going to take a very practical approach.
That's Reuters' Sean Hogan reporting. Ryan Wesley Routh, the man accused in the apparent assassination of Donald Trump at a golf course in Florida, left behind a note saying that he intended to kill the former president, and he kept a handwritten list of dates and venues where Trump was to appear in his car. All this according to new documents the Justice Department released on Monday. The new allegations were included in a detention memo filed ahead of a hearing at which the Justice Department was expected to argue that Ruth should remain behind bars as the case moves forward. The details are meant to buttress prosecutors' assertion that Ruth is a threat to public safety with a premeditated plan to kill Trump. And that's going to wrap it up for us today. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with a 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.